Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. Well, we are hard at work making all our Thanksgiving shows for this year. So in the meantime, here's our Thanksgiving episode from last year. So check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Okay, nothing's normal. We know that, right? But, I don't know, this year? Thanksgiving? Kind of can be normal again? I mean, there are definitely ways of getting together safely now. Eating turkey and pie, whatever spin you like to put on it. Probably watch some football and getting into arguments you swore you would never get into again. And feeling like, wow, I miss this so much. Or maybe it's like, wow, I really miss this? Anyway, however you're planning on celebrating this Thanksgiving, we are going to help you with the food. This episode, we've got the most delicious spice spin on cornbread with Nick Sharma. Genevieve Koh talked about her Chinese-American Thanksgivings and stir-frying greens. The comedian Eric Wareheim gets very serious about the most serious way to serve champagne. And first, we're going to start with turkey. And we forget about the same old golden brown Norman Rockwell bird. We're talking about how to make a beautiful, mopped, smoked barbecue turkey with Rodney Scott, one of the great pitmasters of our lifetime. Hey, Rodney, it's great to talk with you.
How you doing, man?
I'm okay. How are you?
Man, every day's a good day. You know that.
It's literally on your shirt.
Yes.
So, speaking of good days, we are heading into like Thanksgiving season, heading into holiday season. And I want to talk to you about barbecue and turkeys because I actually want to take it a little bit further back because, you know, famously you came up barbecuing whole hogs. When did you start barbecuing turkeys? Like, why was that a thing you started doing?
Wow. So as far back as I can remember, we started barbecuing turkeys. I must have been at least 13, 14 years old. And a lot of people in the area got those free turkeys from their jobs.
Oh, okay.
And they already had a turkey purchased for their dinner. So this extra turkey, they just wanted to try it a different way. And we used to cook the turkeys, and back then we used to finish them with squeezable butter. Remember when butter used to come in the squeeze packs? Yeah. And totally. My dad would have us sauce them and finish them with the butter. And I thought, you know, this is crazy. Nobody's going to ever stick to this. And every year the turkey count just kind of continuously grew. But we had to cut the butter out.
So tell us about barbecue turkey. Like, we know what a beautiful whole hog is like. We know how, like, you know, the mix of the different flavors of different muscles, and we know that smokiness that comes up. I think your style of whole hog is not super duper smoky. Like, that's not really your vibe. Like, you want to get a good smoke flavor on it, but not like knock your socks off. Describe to me what a good barbecue turkey is like.
Well, you know, a good barbecue turkey is kind of like the way we do our whole hogs, which is we do get smoke, but not an overwhelmingly smoke that's too heavy or too bitter. Mm-hmm. And we cook our turkeys pretty much the same way. We spatchcock it and we open it up to slow cook on the grill. It's about a three-hour cook. And it's pretty much the same as whole hog with the hot coals under and slowly cooking it up to temp and saucing it all in between. Oh my God, it's such a good thing, man.
All right, so let's go through the process. But actually, well, maybe I'll start with the word you mentioned, the grill. You know, I know you do a lot of your cooking in pits. You know, most folks don't have a pit.
Correct.
Their own barbecue pit. But when you were testing for the book, you found that you could do this not in like a, I think you weren't using like a regular home grill or a gas grill, but like a green egg or that kind of like heavy grill you found works pretty well.
Correct. We were testing it and we were using the green egg. And I was a little afraid that the green egg would be too hot. But once we learned how to control the temperature, we found out that you can prepare the bird and put it on a green egg and adjust your temperature to sit around 250. And, you know, it's a nice slow cook.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's walk through the process. Do you, you do both, whole turkeys and breasts. Do you have a preference for one or the other for this style of cooking?
We do the whole turkey and the breasts. For this style of cooking, I prefer the whole bird. For some strange reason, seems like the whole bird with the bones and everything that's in it, it adds to the flavor of the cook.
Mm-hmm. Do you brine?
We do not brine. We just pretty much spatchcock our bird mm-hmm. down the back of the spine, kind of like opening a book. And you want to take that spine right out of your way, cut both sides all the way down until it can open and spread like a book or a mm-hmm. butterfly.
Yeah.
And we put our rib rub on both sides and we lay it down on the grill with the meat side up.
Okay. And for the rub, obviously, like, you know, you have a recipe for your rib rub. If people are like making their own or they want to go with, you know, whatever they have or their own flavor profile, what to you is like the non-negotiable you have to have in a rub?
Man, definitely in that rub, you want to have some smoked paprika. You definitely want to have some cayenne in there. And kosher salt would be the way to go with when you're making the rub. Because iodized salt can be a little bit too intense and probably can make your bird a little salty. Mm-hmm, and a little brown sugar, not too much brown sugar. Because if you have too much, the sugar will caramelize on the turkey and kind of give it a charred look. Mm-hmm, and you don't want too much of that all over your turkey.
All right. But okay, I like that mix of the smoked paprika, cayenne, brown sugar, and salt. Like that already sounds delicious.
Oh man, it's good.
Okay, so now you've rubbed it all over, top and bottom. You've got your grill going about 250, and you just lay it on? You just lay the bird on?
You got your grill at 250, you got your rub on your bird, you lay it on there. And you let it cook on that one side with the meat side up for about an hour mm-hmm. and a half. And then you want to have your sauce prepared, you know, whatever sauce that you prefer. In our case, of course, is Rodney sauce. And you want to take that sauce and kind of sauce the bird at that hour and a half mark and flip it over
okay.
to the meat side. And then you want to sauce it again and let it cook there for another hour and a half.
Okay. But wait, let me ask you this. When you're saucing it, you know, I've seen pitmasters like, you know, they mop it. They literally take a mop and like dunk it in the thing. And are you like drenching it or are you just kind of like lightly coating it in sauce? What are you doing with the sauce?
We want to take the sauce and if you got a small brush or small mop, you mm-hmm. want to mop it on. You don't want to drench it. You just want to make sure the sauce is covering the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to put too much sauce on it to a point where the rub tends to rinse off. Because the sauce can, you know, kind of take it away.
Mm-hmm,
so you just
mm-hmm.
want to put enough sauce on there to give the skin flavor and to cover it, but not so much that the rub will come off.
Yeah. Okay. And let me ask you this too, because I think people have this impression of turkey. It's got to have like a really beautiful bronze, crisp skin. I personally think that's a weird thing because like turkey skin never really gets that crisp. Okay. People can still live that fantasy. It's fine. But when you're talking about barbecue turkey like this, you're cooking in low heat, low and slow, you're using the sauce. The skin, the point of this is not to get golden crispy skin, right?
Correct. In the case of barbecuing it on the grill, the skin's going to come out a little bit darker. The color is not going to be as even as you would have in an oven because you're going to have those spots of brown sugar on your rub that's in there. Mm-hmm. It's going to give it more mm-hmm. of a little charred look.
Okay.
And, you know, the legs on the turkey, you're going to start to see the bones start to protrude out of the end of the leg. And I like to call them socks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the socks will start to show. So you got a little bit of white in there. And the skin will probably be almost a couple of different tones. Some spots charred a little bit darker. Some are going to be a little lighter. And some are going to be like in between.
Yeah. Okay. So just so people know what they're expecting, you're not looking for that beautiful golden crisp. You're talking about, you know, you're really slow cooking the birds. So there's not really that kind of heat to brown the skin that way, but you're going to get different textures and flavors out of it.
Correct.
So for the coals and for the smoke, famously, you know, your motto in life is cut, chop, cook, meaning you cut the tree down and then you chop it into logs, you burn that and you use that to cook. Again, for people who are not quite as committed to barbecue as you are, what do we do for our heat? Like, do we, if we're using this sort of home grill setup, you know, can we use briquettes? Like, what source of heat should we use for the right smoke flavor?
Well, for the folks out there that don't have a chainsaw or trees at or trees right there at their arm's reach, I recommend you can go to your local stores, your local hardware stores, or grocery store, and I prefer wood lump charcoal.
Okay.
Which is pretty much the same thing as what we use at the restaurant. At home for the urban cook, you can take wood lump charcoals, get them nice and hot in your grill, and you will still have that wood flavor. It won't be quite as intense as natural wood, but it'll be so close that the difference is, you can barely tell the difference between the two.
Okay. Right on. And like you said, like the end result is a really clean smoke, right? It's not a super crazy smoky turkey.
Correct. It's a nice mild smoke, and it's not a bitter taste, because sometimes, you know, heavy wood and a bluish smoke can give it a bitter taste. Mm. So you definitely want to do hard wood lump charcoals. I prefer those over briquettes.
Right on. What do you put on the table next to the turkey? What are the sides you love?
The sides that I would put on the table next to the turkey, I fell in love with dressing. Maybe about 15, 20 years ago, I fell in love with turkey dressing.
Yeah. How do you make yours?
I don't make it. I always go to somebody else's table.
That's the move.
Man. And of course, some gravy, some good old mac and cheese. Sometimes, I remember when my aunt used to cook for us, sometimes it would be some cabbage there and white rice. But I look so forward to the dressing, the gravy, and the turkey. I'm telling you, man, rarely do I get anything else at Thanksgiving table.
Wait, do you make the gravy with the smoked turkey, or do you make like a traditional gravy to go with the smoked turkey? Because that actually sounds amazing.
Man, I've never made the gravy with smoked turkey, but I think I need to try that. But I feel like that's a great idea, man. Now you got me on to something. I gotta make a note of that.
I also love, as someone who spends his entire life around smoke, like you still enjoy the flavor of it. Like you're like, oh, you can smoke something else, bring it on.
Oh man, I love smoked food. If I'm at a restaurant, I look to see if they have a smoked grill menu. If they do, I order straight off the wood fired grill.
You're a man committed, Rodney.
Man, I can't help it. I got to support this thing in front of me.
Right on, brother. Well, happy Thanksgiving to you. Thanks so much for coming by.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Rodney Scott is the owner of Rodney Scott Barbecue and author of the cookbook Rodney Scott's World of Barbecue. You can find that recipe for that barbecue holiday turkey at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a cheesy spiced cornbread with Nick Sharma. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food. while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and Colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're all about setting up your Thanksgiving table this week, and for many, most of us, that really just means bring on the carbs. For that, we have Nick Sharma here to talk about a recipe that our producer Sally is totally obsessed with, his masala cheddar cornbread. Hey, Nick, it's great to have you.
Hi, Francis. It's so good to be back.
It's always a pleasure. You know, Nick, I have to say, I love that when it comes to like cornbread, for like cornbread lovers, the big controversial opinion is whether like you put sugar in it or not. And your recipe is like, sugar? Sure, here's some sugar and cheese and corn and like five spices while I'm at it. So this is a super maximalist cornbread. Can you describe it for us?
I like cornbread mostly because it's sweet. And so I'm unashamed about that. And I hug the cornbread quite tightly when it's sweet. But I also like the fact that you can have a little bit of cheese in it. You can have a little bit of spice in there. And like you rightly pointed, cornbread is something that's so personal to most of us. For me, it needs to have a lot of these different flavors in there. So that's what I set out to do when I was writing the recipe. And in it, you've got the sweetness that comes from the sweet corn, obviously. Then you've got a little bit of the natural sweetness in there. Like dark brown sugar, you can use jaggery, which is something that I grew up in India eating. It's an unrefined form of sugar that's prepared by concentrating and basically boiling down sugarcane juice or palm sugar from palm trees. And then that's concentrated, solidified, and then sold as a solid, which is jaggery. Mm-hmm. And then there's fennel, which is a spice that most of us are familiar with, which actually carries a very sweet fragrance. So you can cut back on the amount of sugar that's being used in the recipe. And also if your corn isn't as sweet, by introducing a sweet scent from the fennel.
Mm. Yeah. And like, what's the overall effect for you? Is it more cheese forward? Is it more spice forward? Like what is it like when you're eating it? When you're like, oh, this is a good batch.
First of all, it has to be a little bit moist. I don't like it dry, and so that's really important. It shouldn't feel cake-like, but it should still feel moist. And then for me, just running my tongue on that melted cheese is so important because you've got that umami in there, but also it's kind of bittersweet in a way. And then, you know, the sweetness from the corn, and then the fennel just plays so beautifully with it on your mouth that for me, it's a dance of senses, so to speak.
Yeah, and there's some chili for some heat. And do you remember when you came up with it? Like, was there like a point of inspiration? You're like, oh, that's what I'm doing.
So, yeah. So originally it was called, and it is still called, the masala cheddar cornbread. But I started out with garam masala. And it, for some reason, the garam masala was so intense, the flavor pairing just did not work for me. So I said, let me go back and to the drawing board and then just like throw out ingredients and add something new. And so it took, I think for me to come to this, it actually took me 20 different tries to come to fennel. So I started out from where everyone tells you don't start complex. I started out really complex with too many things. And then I started shaving away and I came to fennel.
Oh, right on. Okay. So it's beautiful. It's moist. It's cheesy. There's fennel, there's chilies. And obviously the flavor of the corn itself. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the actual batter. So all of my cornbread education was by real purists who believe that there should only be cornmeal in cornbread. But here you actually use a fair amount of wheat flour. I think it's even like 1-to-1 wheat flour to cornbread. What does the wheat flour do for the cornbread?
Yes. So one of the things I had early on when I was working on this recipe, I read Alice Medrich's cookbook called Flavor Flours. And that's such a brilliant book because Alice, who's one of my favorite pastry cooks, treats flowers as individual subjects in that cookbook. And then she talks about each of their flavors. So when I was creating a recipe for the cornbread, I decided I have to work on texture. I don't want it to feel dense and dry, so I need to incorporate fat as well as something else to support the framework of the cornmeal. Mm-hmm. And I found that I tried, I think, three different flours, if I remember correctly. I tried rye because rye, for some reason in my mind, is such a winter fall kind of flour that people use when they make apple cakes. So I thought rye would be good here, but it ended up being too intense, as well as the texture was off for me. It would become gummy. And then I went back again to what I knew the basics always work. And so I came back to wheat flour, and in this case, all purpose. And that supported the flavor of the cornmeal and didn't take away from it. But at the same time, it helped support the physical structure of the cornbread very well.
Mm. And the spices, you mentioned earlier, you started with a garam masala, you know, blend, and then you kind of like peeled it back and then sort of rebuilt it with coriander, fennel, Aleppo pepper, turmeric, and cayenne. So cayenne, I guess, for heat.
Yeah, so the turmeric, let's start with the turmeric, because the turmeric here is not for flavor at all. It's just for color. Sometimes what happens with sweet corn and even some of the corn flours, they aren't that bright yellow in color, and I feel that's an expectation with cornbread. It needs to be bright yellow. So I went with the trick that most commercial food manufacturers use. They use annatto or turmeric to build on that yellow. And so I did that in there. Turmeric can be quite intense, so I didn't want it to also steal away from the corn. Everything in that bread needs to support the corn, because that's the main thing. The cayenne is in there just for like a little bit of heat. I like a lot of the red pepper flakes that come from the Middle East and from Turkey because they aren't that hot usually, but they do have a bright color, and they also, some of them will have their own distinct aroma.
Yeah, so in this like super case, fruity, like almost like berry-like, yeah. Some of them, yeah.
Yeah, and I think because they don't grind the seeds in it, I think the seeds are removed. I might be wrong on this, but they're not as hot as red pepper flakes that you would get here. So it affords me, I don't like a lot of hot food anyway, so it kind of gives you that balance that I was trying to achieve, at least with this cornbread. And then the fennel and the coriander. Fennel is just such a sweet-smelling spice that it supports, again, the sweetness of the sweet corn. And then coriander has a citrusy note to it. So when it bakes with the rest of the ingredients, it supports the fennel, which then in turn supports the corn. So I built it in such a way that everything, it's kind of like the pyramid that supports the corn that's sitting on top.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love that. And the sweetness, you have honey or dark brown sugar or jaggery. Is it very sweet?
It's very mild. Okay. It just sometimes I've noticed, depending on when corn is harvested, and also if you're harvesting corn and you let it sit out on the kitchen counter, it starts to lose a lot of its sweetness. Mm-hmm. The plant actually converts it back to starch. And so it loses its sweetness. So to account for that and to avoid that, just in case someone who's using fresh corn or corn that wasn't frozen properly, that helps adjust that sweetness a little bit.
Oh, cool. Right on. Well, this sounds awesome to me. I can't wait to make it. Our producer, Sally, has been like, you know, emailing, texting, calling, Zooming, like every form of modern communication, like being like, you have to make this. Make it now. So I'm going to get to it. Thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you, Francis.
Nick Sharma's latest book is The Flavor Equation. You can find his recipe for masala cheddar cornbread at splendidtable.org. Genevieve Coe is just such a pro. She's been a recipe developer for 20 years. She's written or co-written 10 cookbooks and is a senior editor at the New York Times food section. And she's a student of all kinds of home cooking and baking. But honestly, what I really love talking about with her these days is our shared Cantonese Chinese American upbringing, what we learned from it, and in my case at least, how it's influenced me even more than I sometimes realize. Anyway, so while we're talking about Thanksgiving, we're bound to get into some stir-fry talk. Hey Genevieve, it's great to talk with you.
Hey Francis, I'm so happy to be here.
What was Thanksgiving like in your home growing up?
It was such a weird holiday for us because it was new for all of us. My family and all of my extended family, we all really relied on the matriarch of our family to feed us the way we thought we should be fed on Thanksgiving. So she was the first one to come to the U.S. and to bring over everyone in 1965. She's the one who was able to do that, which is amazing, which means she was also the only one who knew how to roast a turkey. But she always stuffed it with her sticky rice stuffing, which was really definitely a Cantonese dish.
Right on.
Yeah. But, Thanksgiving was really fun. We were just trying to figure it out. Like, what should we be eating based on picture books or storybooks or what we learned in school? So there was sort of this mix of things we always had that were both the dishes we expected to eat for any family gathering, any big family party, and then the ones that we thought were Thanksgiving dishes that should be there.
Oh, that's so interesting. So yeah. I think our families came from pretty much the same place.
Yeah, I think so.
My family came from Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that your family kind of gravitated to the idea of Thanksgiving, or at least were like open to it. Because mine was like, I don't know, you guys have to stay off from school? Like, okay, dinner time. You know? And so it was like more us, like the kids, who were sort of pushing our parents to be like, no, it's Thanksgiving. You have to eat this. We have to eat that. You know, and a lot of it was wrapped up with us wanting to belong.
Right,
and, wanting to like not go to school the next day and be like weird because we didn't have turkey and we didn't have mashed potatoes. Like, I don't think we literally ever had mashed potatoes in our home. Like, I don't think mashed potatoes existed in our home, you know? So we didn't want to be weirdos. So we were always like telling our parents, oh, we got to make this, we got to make this. But your family kind of, at least, was like open to it. Sounds like they were.
Yeah. Like,
what should we do?
But really the only thing we did have was that turkey. And it was such a bizarre, it was always sort of a bizarre thing for all of us, the big turkey. But it was beautiful and it felt so special to have this huge roast turkey. But all of the other dishes would be Chinese, essentially, including there were always multiple other proteins because nobody wanted to eat the turkey. There's always like steamed fish or like some, you know, there were always other proteins. We did eat the turkey. I do think for the younger generations, it was a bit of it was almost like a fun, like, adventure into these foods that we normally never ate. You know, the cranberry sauce out of a can. That was really a marvel to experience. And it was just so foreign and sort of delightful. But we didn't really have mashed potatoes or sweet potatoes or green bean casserole or any of those things until my generation, or our generation, I should say, Francis, since we're in the same sort of firstborn in America generation, until we became adults and we started bringing dishes.
So what do you do now? I mean, I think it's so interesting that you said, like, in your family, as you grew up and you started doing more in the cooking, that you brought those things that, like, you know, you would make for the cover of magazines. like gourmet and so on and so forth.
Right.
And so, like, what do you, when you are cooking Thanksgiving now, what do you like to do?
Gosh, the funny thing about Thanksgiving now is that, sort of to your point, having done this feast for magazine covers over so many years, it's a funny thing because I think for most people, the Thanksgiving feast is this once a year really special moment. And for my kids, the way they experience it is, well, we have Thanksgiving over a dozen times every summer. Like, July is Thanksgiving.
Because
in a magazine world, that's when we do it. And I, you know, I've done all of those essentials, the cornbread, the pies, the biscuits, and do it over and over and over again to perfect the recipes. So to be totally frank, by the time Thanksgiving around, I mean, I'll still make this stuff. But, you know, it's sort of sad, I think, because of that, my kids and even me, like, we're a little bit over the Thanksgiving meal because we eat it so much. But there are, you know, but I do like to tell them stories of when we used to all gather, so many generations, so many people, and we used to do this in their Gong Gong and Popo, their grandparents' house. And now with the travel, it's not really possible. But when we do get together now with a family, we will still then have basically everything else that we had on the Thanksgiving table aside from the turkey. So we'll always have rice. We'll always have steamed fish and other proteins. And then we'll always have lots and lots of veggies. And since my kids are vegetarians, that's always their favorite. Lots and lots of stir-fried bok choy or gai lan or just other Chinese greens. And then lots of tofu as well. But we basically have that sort of same feast, just not on Thanksgiving Day, and we have it without the turkey.
And you have it 12 times in June.
Right.
But you know, actually, I love you bringing up having stir-fried greens. I wanted to talk about that for a couple of reasons. One is that because, you know, I think there's sort of this fun game that food people like to play, which is, what is Thanksgiving missing? You know, and I feel like, oh, Samin Nosrat really got people talking about how, you know, in that typical Thanksgiving menu, there's no acid.
Right.
Like she got people really like talking about how there's no acid aside from the cranberry sauce or the cranberry jelly or whatever. To me, I always feel like what the table is missing is something that tastes freshly cooked. Everything is roasted.
Yep.
Or like there are salads. And I love all that stuff. But you kind of want something with like that little bit of singe flavor, something that tastes like it came straight out of a hot pan. And you wrote this lovely thing. It was more like a technique piece in the New York Times about how you have learned to sort of mimic stir frying, the flavor of wok hay, which comes from stir frying, but you doing it without a wok.
Right.
So tell us about that non-wok method.
Sure, absolutely.
Stir frying greens.
Yeah, I think I spent so much of my adult cooking life chasing that flavor that I knew so well from, mainly from restaurants, to be honest. That particular smoky singed taste of vegetables that have wok hay. And to your point, they do have that smoky flavor and they taste simultaneously really fresh, right? You've lost that raw edge and you've replaced it with this, like, to me, it does almost taste like it's just been licked by the flames, like really lightly. Yeah. So it's singed, but it has this unique
I think that's
crispness.
Literally what it is, actually.
Yeah. And I found that the best way for me to get that, but also the best way for me to get that, to be clear, like on a really busy weeknight or when I just want something on the table, is just through my regular skillet, because the, you know, the bottom obviously is wider and flatter and just meant to sit on a standard stove. And so if I just let that heat, you get this heat that is much more intense and to me closer to what maybe would happen on an actual wok burner. It's never going to be the same, right? Like, who are we kidding? I think Kenji Lopez-Aldis, brilliant. And I think he came the closest with a great technique that he described also in the New York Times, using a torch, which I have, a propane torch, but, you know, I think it was a little tricky to do that on a regular weeknight.
Torch their food at the end for that little flavor.
On a regular weeknight, or especially when I had toddlers, it was not, I kept the torch hidden. But I found that the shallow sides of a skillet and the wide bottom of a skillet let me get enough heat to actually create that singed, seared flavor in the pan if I just let the vegetables sit there for a little bit. And then what I do is I add a splash of water and I cover it really fast. And that water actually steams the vegetables through to that crisp, tender state. And then I let it finish uncovered to get it a little more smoky. And then I add the seasonings at the very end. And that, to me, mimics the most closely that experience of wok hay, you know, in terms of flavor, but also just allows me to be able to pass that taste on to my kids on a regular basis. You know, my kids know that, like, okay, when Gong Gong, when my grandfather calls everyone to come and eat, he has not yet stir-fried the vegetables. That's always like, they know that already. Like, everything else is going to be sitting out and ready to go. And once everybody comes and gathers, then he throws everything, all the vegetables into stir-fry, because we want to also eat them while they're still in that steaming hot stage.
Yeah, totally. You know, so this flavor of wok hay, it's not literally a flavor in the sense that it's a seasoning or anything like that. It's famously, it's translated as breath of the wok, but it's about like an energy.
Right.
And so it dissipates.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like even in a great restaurant, when they say a great restaurant has a lot of wok hay in their food, it means they're good at the technique of creating that flavor. But like that flavor is sort of like understood to only be there for the first few moments that the food is on the table.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I love that. Like, it's like, okay, time to eat, sit down, and then I'll cook this thing. I actually have this theory, and I bet Kenji goes into it in more detail. I think we're sort of aligned on it. But I think the flavor of wok hay is literally, because so much of the food, traditionally when you're stir frying in a wok, is tossing the food.
Right, yep.
And the huge flames are like coming up the sides. I think what it is actually a little bit of the oil actually igniting, catching on fire. And that's like in a French restaurant, or used to cook, like, oh, if you ever, like, burnt the oil in the pan. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. if you ever caught the pan on fire, even if you like, you know, get it out in a second, like yeah. my chef would make you throw it out because like it ruined the flavor.
Right.
And I remember that smell because I would do it all the time and, you know, get yelled at. But I remember that smell. I would be like, no, it's a good smell for me because yeah. that smells yeah. like, well, hey. So yeah. it's sort of funny. It's just, you know, culturally what's prized. But yeah. anyway.
But actually, you get that effect. So this is part of the reason why I do use a skillet too. So, you know, yeah. like a standard skillet that has sort of shallower sides. So I, you know, I had enough oil to just sort of coat the pan. I throw in like my garlic or my ginger just to like give the oil that bit of an aroma. And, you know, one of the keys is to like throw those vegetables in all at once, right? It's not like a little careful, slow placing of them, you're, like just mm-hmm, toss mm-hmm. them in all at once. And when you do that with a skillet with really shallow sides, you do get a little bit of splash over of the oil that's already in the pan. And so,
oh, cool. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So if you are using a gas stove, you do get a little bit of that. You know, it doesn't necessarily ignite and flame up like at a huge,
at a
wok station. Because,
call the fire department thing.
Yeah, but sort of the relative equivalent. But even that, I think, is just enough to give it a little bit of that, oil flavor.
That energy.
Yeah, it catches. It catches right at the edge of like, you know, when the sides are only like 1.5 or 2 inches high. Yeah.
We'll be back with more with Genevieve Coe from the New York Times. And coming up, comedian Eric Wareheim with detailed instructions on how to be the life of the party, and it involves a sword. Stick around. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking great Thanksgiving ideas this episode. Let's get back into it with senior editor at New York Times Cooking, Genevieve Coe. I want to get back to this piece you wrote, though, because like I said, it was mostly a technique piece. But you started it in a very poignant way, I thought, because you started by saying you were sitting with your child and you were eating mooncakes, mm-hmm. which are an extremely Chinese thing. And your child saying to you, you know, they don't feel very Chinese. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you saying, you know, you think about that and you think about the fact that you don't cook with a wok mm-hmm. and how sometimes that makes you also wonder about, you know, your Chinese-ness or whether mm-hmm. or not you're passing enough
right.
Chinese-ness to your children. Tell me about that. Tell me about that feeling and what that means to you.
Yeah, it's a really tough one, and one I've been working through for a long time and has really hit home because my twins recently left for college and one of them at least needs to cook, you know, cook for herself. And it has been this, you know, thinking about how different their upbringing has been, thinking about no matter how hard I have tried to keep them connected, you know, to their culture, you know, in the happiest way through food. And that's mainly, to be totally frank, often is mainly by eating out, and especially mm-hmm. with their grandparents or with family. And then in ways that they find torturous in the same way that I found torturous, which is my parents made me take Chinese school every Saturday. Like all the other kids were having fun and I had to go to Chinese school.
Oh, so that ended for me like 3 months into it.
Oh but my God, you're so lucky. I mean, that was my whole childhood.
I was just awful. And my parents were like, oh, fine, forget it. We're not going to spend the money. Anyway, sorry.
I was awful too. And I just had to keep going and it was terrible. So I didn't make my kids do that, but I did make them all take Chinese in high school, which they do not appreciate, to put it mildly. But it has just been watching this quick slip of that connection. You know, when I was growing up, we had Cantonese food pretty much every night. And now, you know, I would say it's partly the nature of my job in that I am constantly developing and testing recipes from all different cuisines. And I love doing that. And I think my kids really enjoy trying all these different things. But it does mean that they don't have the same connection to, say, that very particular smell of the home always smelling like steamed rice, right? Like, so sometimes mm-hmm. our house smells like steamed rice, and other times it smells like tortillas heating, and other times it smells like farro simmering. So, you know, it has just been this really interesting thing to watch and to wonder, well, can I continue to help them stay connected to their culture without having to necessarily do the exact same things as the way I was raised? You know, I guess it just begs these questions of, one, is it inevitable? And two, even if it is inevitable, is it terrible? Does that make sense? Like, I've always thought, like, oh, no, it's automatically terrible. Now I'm like, I'm a bad mom and I'm a bad Chinese person and they don't know and they don't have these connections. But it was actually my parents who helped me sort of work through that when I was, quite frankly, scolding them, my parents, for not speaking to my kids exclusively mm-hmm. in Chinese. Mm-hmm, and, you know, this was when the kids were all very young, like toddlers, and my parents quickly went from speaking to them in Chinese, as they had with me and my siblings, to speaking to them in English. And, you know, I was saying, well, no, we're depending on you for this. Like, this is, you're supposed to be the one to help them keep this connection. Yeah. And, you know, they said, well, of course we want to help them keep this connection. But they said, but, you know, it's easier for us to speak to them in English. Like, and they point out, you know, we've been in this country longer than we haven't been. We came to this country for a reason and we like it here, you know. And my parents had very consciously raised us in a way that they didn't want us to either assimilate too quickly or want it. So I grew up in a Chinese American community that was majority Asian, actually. So that was part of the reason I grew up with such close ties to the culture. But, you know, as I've seen my kids grow and evolve and now at an age where they're working through these questions of identity, you know, I'm realizing that it's important for me to help them stay connected in ways that make sense and in ways that are practical. And to be totally frank, part of what inspired me to write that story and to share that technique was I was writing it for that kid who now has to cook for herself. She texted mm-hmm. me a photo of a bag of Brussels sprouts and said, what do I do? How do I do this the way you do it? How do I get that taste, right? And I knew, having helped her get settled in her place, that, you know, she has like a little electric burner, right? She doesn't have a gas stove. So that article is to say, like, hey, here's how you do it. Here's how you do it with what you have and where you are with life. And yeah, actually it is Chinese and that's okay. And it's not the same way my parents did it, but even the way, when, you know, whatever my parents did wasn't the same way their parents did things. And, you know, it's just part of this evolution as generations grow up here. So.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I appreciate hearing about your parents' take on it, which was, you know, we've been here a long time and, you know, we've grown comfortable speaking English. We're comfortable speaking to our grandchildren in English. And, you know, and I think there are lots of ways you can interpret that. You know, part of me wants to say, like, no, it should be just as American to speak Chinese as it is to speak English. But there's also a way to interpret it, which is like, hey, they put in their time. You know, they put in their time and their to raise their children with the kinds of connections to the culture that they did. And, you know, maybe they deserve a break too. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is always a push and pull. And,
yeah. I think there, you know, I will just say, I think there's so much, to be totally frank, I think there's so much heartbreak in feeling and watching and experiencing culture slip away with this generation. But I think what I've seen, the sort of upside with my kids and even with their friends, is that they get to experience so many other cultures on the dinner table every night, and then even around Thanksgiving, to continue to see that evolve, that Thanksgiving isn't just this one menu or this one thing, but that it can be a million things. And I think that's been a really great experience for us each year.
Totally, totally. Thanks so much, Genevieve.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Genevieve Coe is a senior editor at New York Times Cooking and is the author of the cookbook, Better Baking, Wholesome Ingredients, Delicious Desserts. And she left us with a little recipe for your Thanksgiving table, coconut pumpkin flan. Find it at splendidtable.org. Eric Wareheim is, I don't know, how do I describe Eric Wareheim? He's very, very tall. He's one of the great alt-comedy impresarios in America today. He's a star of Tim and Eric's awesome show, Great Job, co-star of Master of None, and he's the director of pretty much every commercial you've seen in the last 10 years that's made you go, what on earth did I just watch, and why do I suddenly want to buy deodorant and light bulbs? Anyway, I know that might not be the most obvious introduction for a Thanksgiving show guest, but one thing Eric takes deeply, earnestly, seriously is food and drink, especially wine. And he's a New York Times best-selling cookbook called Foodheim. So we want to get into what he thinks is the perfect wine progression for Thanksgiving dinner. Eric Wareheim, it's going to be fun to talk with you.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm going to try to bring all of my 100% funny energy today.
What we love about you is complexity.
Yeah.
Don't feel like you need to be funny for us, Eric. Just be you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
So let's talk about wine.
It's my favorite thing to talk about.
Do you have strong Thanksgiving wine opinions? Apparently people have strong Thanksgiving wine opinions.
Oh, yeah. I wake up and I think about the wines that I'm going to drink that evening and what dishes I'm going to eat and what progression. That's how like freakish I am about it. But for for Thanksgiving, you always start with champagne, I would say. Real champagne or something super elegant. I would personally, my progression is always whites to reds. For something like Thanksgiving, I would definitely be drinking like a Chablis, a Chardonnay from France. I would do white Burgundy. I would also do a dry Riesling. And then with the turkey, I would go both ways. I would definitely have like a white Burgundy because that works well with turkey and gravy and stuff, but I also do something like maybe a Jura Trousseau or a Poussard or a blend of Pinot Noir and those. That's like a light, like juicy red that would kind of work with the turkey. But I wouldn't do anything heavier than something like that. I would not do anything like Bordeaux or a Cab, you know, anything, because I just think that would overpower the white meat. And then I would finish with some Auslese Riesling. I'm very into Riesling right now, so I could just...
You're German. You
know, for dessert, yeah. If you're doing pie or ice cream or anything, nice Auslese would be amazing. Then I would do an Amaro. If I'm not like wasted by that point, I would do a little Amaro to kind of settle my stomach. That's my progression for Thanksgiving.
Right on. That is the full progression.
Yeah.
Thank you for the whole rainbow.
Yes.
And so, okay, so it's time to party, so which means it's time to champagne. Is it time to savor?
Yeah, it's always, always time to savor. Yeah, it depends on how drunk you are. You know, like, keep your savoring for the beginning of the meal, pop that champagne, make sure it's super cold, but it's fun. In my book, you know, I teach you how to do it. You can do it with a butter knife, you can do it with a sword, you can do it with your iPhone. But once you get the technique down, it's like a real fun trick. But then you got to stop doing it after you had a couple glasses of wine, because it can get super dangerous. I'm sure you've seen the exploding videos on the internet.
I haven't seen them. I can only imagine. Okay, so for folks who don't know what savoring is, they might be wondering, what is this thing that you can do with a butter knife or a sword or an iPhone?
Yeah.
So actually, take us a step back.
Yeah.
Tell us what savoring is, how to do it, and why you love it.
It's so funny. I just stumbled upon the history of sabering during war times, where you had a bayonet on your gun or your rifle, and you just won a battle. You pop out the champagne and you take the bayonet off and you run the knife against the bottle, and it would just, with light pressure, you can pop the glass and the cork off. So I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes sense. Because it's kind of a ceremonial thing. You take champagne, make sure you take the cage off and you take any kind of the covering off. And mm-hmm. you just run a little blade. You find the seam of the champagne and make sure it's ice cold. If it's warm, the bottle could blow up. Okay. Make sure it's a champagne or something. Just make sure it's very carbonated. Some of the lower carbonation pet nats will not work. And then you just run a blade along that seam and you gently push.
Yeah, there's actually like a little, almost like a little ridge along the bottle that you can feel, right? It's like kind of where the glass comes together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with a little bit of pressure, you hit the lip, which is still the glass, and it pops the glass and the cork away. So we aim it into like the woods, the back. There's probably a graveyard of a bunch of glass shards. And you do a little scream or you say happy Thanksgiving or some kind of, I usually do a roar because it's a rush of energy. And then, just make sure you don't slam it from the bottle. I've seen that too, which is very scary because it is a hard glass edge.
Oh, okay. So basically you've got your champagne.
Yeah.
Ice cold. You're holding it in your hand. You find the part of the bottle that has like a little ridge that leads all mm-hmm. the way up to the top.
Yeah.
Take off the cage
mm-hmm.
and you get your knife
mm-hmm.
and you, while you're holding the champagne in your hand, you run the knife along the bottle to hit the lip of the cork and the thing just goes and like busts off.
Yeah. Just aim the bottle, aim it away from people and then you just do it. Yeah. You don't want to do any, a lot of people like think it's slamming it down or using a lot of force. It's not, it's really about the physics of the, how much energy is already in that bottle.
Oh, yeah. Because really, it's like, all that carbonation is already pushing against
the
cork.
It's a cool feeling, and it's a cool sound. It just kind of has this like, amazing pop, and it's really, it's wild how a little pressure you got to do.
Yeah. It's so festive, and it has roots in violence, just like Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Exactly. You got to have a little danger and fun. Also, it's fun to have a saber sword around. I have like a big sword that I have on my deck when I have dinner parties. So it's good, it's a good, fun way to begin the night. I actually have multiple sabers because, when it got out to my friends, it became a good Christmas gift for me.
All right, man. It has been a blast talking with you. Thanks so much.
Same. Thanks so much for having me on. It's awesome.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Eric Wareheim is one half of the comedy duo Tim and Eric and is the author of the cookbook Foodheim, a culinary adventure. So that is our show for the week. But hey, before we go, let me leave you with one piece of advice. Something that's going to set you up for success if you're hosting Thanksgiving this year. Whether you plan on sabering champagne or not, just get the drinks cold before people come over. Keep a lot of snacks on hand. Get some nuts, some chips, maybe a cheese board, whatever. Just give people something to keep their hands and mouths occupied. And then just think. Dinner time is going to be when dinner's ready. You got this. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And if you don't already, check out our podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get yours. Subscribe to our weekly recipe newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Sign up at splendidtable.org. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.